Today is Tuesday, November 10th, 2020. This is a part four Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Glad to hear it. Carl, may we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. We ended up, wrapped up part three. It sounded like you were going to get a seasonal job to spend the summer at Scotty's Castle in Death Valley. But then suddenly they, and this is a part of your working your career with the Park Service, going from seasonal job to seasonal job. And this is 1980. But then they called you back and said they didn't have the funding. Remind us again then, what did you do?
Oh, okay, well, you know what, I panicked. My 180-day appointment was just about to run out at Petrified Forest, so I was scrounging around for jobs and discovered that the Forest Service had not filled all their fire crews in Arizona. So I quick dashed off applications to all the national forests, and I did get a job offer from the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest at the Hebo Ranger District.
Hey, Carl, I'm going to jump in here. Does it matter? I mean, you're working seasonally with the Park Service and trying to build up your relationship with the Park Service. To switch and work for the Forest Service, did that keep you in the government sort of pool? How did that work, your relationship with the Park Service?
You know, once the 180-day appointment was over, you were just out.
Okay.
And so, from a personnel standpoint, it didn't matter. The 180 days was that you had was position specific.
But would the employment with the Forest Service help you in any way with future employment with the Park Service?
Well, it did in terms of adding to my job experience.
Okay.
And it was a federal job, so once I finally got on permanent, it did count towards my time in federal service and that sort of thing.
Okay. All right. Were you aware of that when you heard you weren't going to go to Death Valley, or were you just like, I need a job? Hey, I hear I can fight fire.
It was mostly I hear I can fight fire.
Okay. Had you fought fire before?
No. Nope. I had zero experience in that arena. In fact, as soon as I sent out the applications, you know, I was doing some research and found out that, okay, I have to pass a step test to actually get the job. And so I was out running every day trying to get myself in better shape.
What's a step test?
Step test is, oh gosh, I forget how high the step is. It's about a foot high. But they set up a metronome and it ticks away, and you go up, right foot up, left foot up, right foot down, left foot down, right foot up, left foot up, and it's a relatively brisk pace. And then at the end of 3 minutes, they would take your pulse, and then, well, they take your pulse immediately after you finish doing it for 3 minutes, and then some specified time later, they would take your pulse again, and your pulse had to slow down a certain amount to indicate that you were in shape. So that was the step test. They also could do it with a run, where you had to run 3 miles in a specific amount of time.
Were you wearing a pack when you were doing the step up, step down?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right, and they said, okay, you've got the job, but you have to have this test, or did you get the test done and before they offered you the job?
They offered me the job, and it was conditional on my passing the step test.
Got it.
Once I showed up for it.
Makes sense.
And then I also had to have a physical, which was as I recall, no big deal. It was at the Holbrook Hospital, so
okay.
It was kind of, oh, you look like you're in good shape. Sign the papers, and away we go.
Great. Okay, so you showed up at Heber. Where exactly is Heber, and where did you stay, and how did that work?
Okay, Heber is it's a twin cities. Each one of them at the time probably had hundreds of people living in it. Heber Overgaard is along the Mogollon Rim in central Arizona. It's almost straight south of Winslow. It's right to the south is the Apache Reservation and the Tonto National Forest, just off the Mogollon Rim there. And then to the north is the Painted Desert. We were, from a town standpoint, when it came time to go shopping or whatever, we were about halfway between Payson and Sholo. So sometimes I go to Payson and sometimes I go to Sholo.
Okay.
But it was a Forest Service District office, District Ranger, Forest Service, and so there was a whole administrative setup there, shops, fire station. We had, they call them engines now. At the time, we called them tankers. So we had about three or four tanker crews, a helitech crew, and a hotshot crew. And our primary responsibility was the section of the National Forest along the Mogollon Rim, for about, I'd say probably about 20 miles each side of Heber. And so that was our primary responsibility. Depending on the fire danger and fire activity in our district, we could also be dispatched to other places to fight fire.
Okay. Were you trained through sort of a tanker crew, helitech crew, or you trained through the different positions, or did they just say, okay, you're going to be a blah, and that was that?
When they hired me, they weren't sure if I was going to be on helitech or tanker crew. And by the time I got there, they decided I was going to be on a tanker crew. And there were some basic firefighter classes that we had to take. I did miss a couple of them because I wasn't there. They'd hired me at the last minute. And so I missed out on some of the movies and lectures and that kind of stuff that we had at the beginning, or that they offered at the beginning of the training. But there was, there were a couple of others of us that had shown up, as I recall, late. And it didn't seem to be a big deal. It was kind of like, okay, well, here you are, so you're going to get the rest of the training. And then we did the housing was basically a couple of big bunkhouse sort of things. We each had a room that we shared with one other guy, and then a bathroom with a toilet and a shower, and a little kitchen set up. We went through the training in Heber. Instead of doing a step test initially, they had us do the run. And so it was the second or third day I was there, I have to do the run. And it's like, okay, my job for the summer depends on this. And so they had a course set out for us, 3 miles long. It was actually three laps through the housing area and a couple of forest roads and stuff nearby. And the guy who was running the stopwatch actually didn't know how to work the stopwatch.
Ooh.
And so I finished my first lap, and he called out my time, and my time was two-thirds gone. And I thought, oh, my God. And so I just really poured it on for the last two laps. Well, it turned out I finished the run in plenty of time. He just didn't know how to read the stopwatch. And So they actually thought I was in much better shape than I really was. So we had a couple of weeks of training, and then our daily routine was that we would get up, we'd show up for work at, I think it was 7, it might have been 6, but early in the morning for usually about an hour of physical training, PT time. And each day would have different emphasis, and they were led by our crew leaders or the hotshot members of the hotshot crew. Sometimes it always included a run, and sometimes it was just a run, and other times, you know, just all different kinds of calisthenics and exercises and lugging logs around and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Then after PT, we had about an hour off, and that was, you know, time to go eat breakfast and get into our Nomex, our fire retardant little outfits. And then we go out and work for the day. And if there was no fires burning, they had various fuel reduction programs that we were working on. We referred to it as stick stacking.
Hmm.
But we'd go out where there had been thinning projects in the woods and drag all the slash together and put them together in slash piles. We would also spend time familiarizing ourselves. Each tanker, each fire engine, had its specific response area. And so we would go out and patrol our response area just to get familiar with the road so that when there was a fire, we'd know how to get there, and also to see if there were any fires that were just there that nobody'd spotted yet.
Mm-hmm.
Our particular response area was right along the Mugyong Rim at a town called Forest Lakes, which is in the far, far southeast corner of Coconino County. And it's right where Highway 260 comes up over the rim. And so usually Mondays, we would spend pretty much the whole day putting out abandoned campfires.
Oh, wow.
And all the people from Phoenix that had driven up and camped along the rim over the weekend and then put out their fire with piles of pine needles or whatever. So we would do that. On Sundays, there was a Forest Service campground in our response area. And so we would do a little fire demonstration of, you know, how do we fight forest fires? Here's some real forest firefighters to show us how it's done.
Hmm.
And of course we had the usual Smokey the Bear schlock to hand out to all the kids, and we would finish off the program by hosing everybody down with the tanker truck.
Kids like that.
One time we were doing the program and got called out to a fire halfway through. So we immediately threw back on our Nomex, because usually we did this in T-shirts.
Hmm.
Threw our Nomex back on again and hauled out of there. And the ranger, the forest ranger who would introduce us, pretty much continued the program by having everybody gather around the radio and they listened to us.
Oh, wow.
He kind of
cool.
interpreted what we were doing to the folks and said they loved it.
Cool.
So that was kind of the routine when we weren't fighting fires. If we were dispatched to a fire, if it was in our response area, we would be stuck with the initial attack, and we would decide, you know, if it was just one tree on fire, why we could handle it ourselves. If it was bigger, we would call in and ask for reinforcements. So I fought fires on the district that were everything from a single tree up to, I guess on our district, maybe the biggest fire we had was about 50 acres. Then I was also dispatched to a larger fire up on the Coconino National Forest, just immediately north of Kendrick Park, area that was burned in the Crescent Fire years later, so you can't even see the scar from the fire that I fought.
Mm.
But that was my first big fire. I'd been on the crew for a couple of weeks, I guess, and they sent us out, and we were working 12-hour shifts. We had the night shift, and so we go to work at 6 in the evening and get off work at 6 in the morning, and be out there digging line and spraying down fires and stuff all night long, and then go to sleep in the broad daylight.
Trying to.
It's kind of surprising how well you can sleep. we did that for 4 or 5 days, and then we went in, came back in, slept all day, got up, and our crew leader went to find out what our assignment for that night was, and came back and said, well, they're not doing the night shift anymore.
Hmm.
He's going, well, now what are we going to do? We just slept for 7 hours. As it turned out, we were perfectly capable of sleeping for another 7 hours. Slept all night long and then went out and worked on the mop-up the next day. But that's when I found out that, the stuff that we learned in the training classes was good stuff to know, but it was more of an academic relationship to what actually went on a fire.
How do you mean? What were you learning? What was on-the-job training teaching you?
On the job, it was the whole operation was much more directed. You were told pretty much exactly what you were supposed to do, but at the same time, it was a lot more ad hoc. There wasn't as much strategy and grand planning that you got the impression from the fire courses that actually went on. It was much more just dealing with the situation at hand.
Okay. Trying to get a fire line around, trying to contain the fire perimeter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I did that fire on the Coconino, and then in the middle of the summer, towards the end of July, they sent us up. There was a fire up on the Arizona Strip, BLM land north of the canyon, but still in Arizona. And so we drove up to St. George, and then they sent us out, sent us south of St. George onto the Strip. Our guide, they drove us. One of the big things in fire is you never know where you're going to go. If you're at the bottom of the totem pole like I was, you just go where you're told. So I had no idea where we were going. And we drove south of St. George, then we go up through this pinyon and juniper and go through a little meadow, then we get into this big valley. And I look at the east side of the valley as we're driving south, and it's kind of like, that looks like the rock layers in the Grand Canyon over there. I wonder if those are the Grand Wash Cliffs. Sure enough, they were. That night, I could see Mead View twinkling way, way off to the south.
Oh, wow.
So we got out to fire camp. We helped set up fire camp out in the middle of the Grand Wash Trough, a place called Olaf Knolls. And there were a bunch.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the knolls?
Oh, Olaf. O-L-A-F-F.
Thank you.
And there were, I think they had five, I'm not exactly sure, five fires, lightning starts burning around there, and they were dispatching us out to the different fires. So we helped set up fire camp, and then they sent us out to one of the fires, which was actually up in the Grand Wash Cliffs. And they sent a local guide with us who got lost, and so once he was lost, we were almost out of gas, and they didn't have gas at fire camp yet, so they told us to go back into St. George. So we kind of, St. George is north of here, so we'll just keep going north. And we found our way back into St. George, filled up with gas, came back down, and actually, I think we had a drum of gas in our truck to take to fire camp. And then they sent us out again to the fire, which we did find eventually. And so we worked on that fire did some line. And then they stationed us in Jump Up Canyon, which is one of the canyons draining off the Shibwitz Plateau into Grand Wash, west of the Grand Canyon. Stationed us along a little two-track out there that we were supposed to hold, and they were going to let the fire back down to that little two-track. And so we held that two-track. But the hotshot crew up the road in denser pinyon juniper didn't, and so the fire hooked back around us, and we had to pull out and get out of the Grand Wash Cliffs and go back to fire camp. And by the time we got back into fire camp, we'd been working for 36 hours.
Wow.
And so we were pretty well exhausted, you know, just kind of threw the paper sleeping bag down in the dirt, laid on top of it, and slept for 8 hours or whatever. And then the next morning we went up and did a burnout to on that same fire up on top of the Grand Wash Cliffs to kind of bring it back under control. Kind of exciting. It was burnout was along another two track, and there was there were three trucks in line. The first truck was going through and lighting the burnout. They had guys tossing fusees and flamethrower and all that kind of stuff, shooting off one side of the road. And then the two trucks behind, our job was to come behind and cool off the fire that they had just started right alongside the road so it wouldn't jump the road.
Got it.
after we were done. And so the tanker that I was on was the third in line, and we started off, and by this time the fire had only been burning for, you know, like maybe 3 or 4 minutes, but the wood was really dry, and it was pinyon and juniper, so it was just going up like a torch. And we got about 10 feet in, and my job was to stand in the bed of the tanker. It's essentially a pickup truck with a water tank and a water pump in the bed. And so I'm standing back there running the engine and spraying the water while the other two guys are in the cab. We got about 50 feet in, and I'm beating on the roof. I was just getting burned alive back there. So they backed out, and I kind of rearranged my clothing, and then we started back in again, and I'm back there with my hose, and it was just kind of a sweep the fire, sweep the truck, spray myself, sweep the fire, sweep the truck, spray myself.
Wow.
And I was bone dry by the time I would spray myself again, so it was just that hot.
Wow.
But we did manage to keep the fire from jumping that road, and it was a successful burnout. So we were on those fires for close to a week, working along the the fire that we were on was right on top of the Grand Wash Cliffs, and there was one evening where a thunderstorm came up. This was July, so thunderstorm came up, and we were down in fire camp at the Grand Wash Trough there, and the fire blew up, burned to the edge of the Grand Wash Cliffs, but still within the line, so that was okay. And then we could see burning logs falling from the top of the Grand Wash Cliffs down over the cliffs, lighting the vegetation growing in the cracks on the cliffs. This was all just right at sunset and as it was getting dark, so just absolutely
wow.
Spectacular.
Wow.
So like I say, we worked there for about a week, got the fires under control enough. They released us, so we drove back up to St. George and back down to Heber. As we went into St. George, we weren't sure if we were going to get dispatched to another fire or if we were going to get sent home. So we still had all of our gear. Our tanks were all full of water and all that kind of stuff. And got into St. George and said, no, we're sending you home. So we went up I-15 out of St. George and then over through Hurricane and decided that we'd drive through Zion. So we stopped alongside the road on I-15 right there at the turnoff to head towards Zion. And I sat in the driver's seat and kept the engine running and all that kind of stuff while everybody else got out and changed out of their Nomex, their fire retardant clothes, into regular clothes, t-shirts and stuff. And then it was my turn. And so I got out and I had just stripped down to my shorts, and they drove away on purpose, left me standing there by the side of I-15. Eventually I ran them down in my bare feet along the road shoulder and got my clothes and got dressed. A couple weeks later, the guy who was driving opened up his lunch pail out there in the woods, and lo and behold, there was this just disgusting pair of fire socks in his lunchbox.
That's all he had to eat for lunch was old moldy fire socks? Who did that?
I have no idea how that happened, of course.
My, oh my.
But
what a hard job.
Yeah. So that was my summer.
Carl, and, did you guys have a backpack like full of gear when you were there? I guess if you're assigned to a tanker, are you cutting line or using Pulaski for that? Did you have like a fire pack kind of thing?
Yeah, you would always have you'd always have your fire pack of some kind. We had a it was kind of like an extra large knapsack that we kept all of our stuff that we would need on the line, and we would have that with us all the time. And then we would also have another bag so that if we were, because if they were going to dispatch us off the forest to someplace more distant, we'd need some other personal stuff.
Okay.
More underwear.
Yeah.
And so we'd have that bag
socks
to grab as well. Yeah. And so we'd always have those ready. And and with the working on the tanker, we had a tank of water, but it was only about 200 gallons.
Okay.
So we would still do a lot of shovel and Pulaski and McLeod work because the water that we had wasn't enough to put out a fire. It was enough to help us to control a fire.
Okay.
And then we were capable, if the fire was close to a water source, we were capable of drafting water to either refill our tank or just pump directly on a fire. There was one time where we had a burning tree, and it was actually close enough to a stock tank that we were able to draft directly out of the stock tank and squirt it on the tree.
Okay.
So that was the only time that we had a virtually unlimited supply of water.
And that's I'm thinking more of a brush truck than a tanker, a sort of an old military deuce and a half with a 5,000 gallon tank on it or something like that. So this would be more of a sort of like a one-ton pickup kind of thing.
Yeah. There were bigger tankers. So I was on what was called a Model 20, which was basically a one-ton pickup. It was a utility truck. It had the the storage bins along the side.
Got it.
And then the water tank and the pump just slipped in.
Right.
And into the bed, and then the cab was just a standard cab, and okay. three of us there in the cab usually.
Okay.
So yeah, I think it was a Model 70, which was a much larger. It had a bigger tank, a bigger bigger pump, more gear, and more people. And we had one of those in Heber, and then I think we had three of the Model 20s.
Okay.
So
back to Heber after the
yep,
after
back,
the strip.
Back to Heber. That was the big fire, and then along about the 1st of September, people started going back to school, this, that, and the other, and we just in those days. By the 1st of September, fire season was pretty much over, and so they started laying us off, and the first part of September, after Labor Day weekend, my job there ended, and it was an interesting job. I learned a lot about chainsaws that I wished I'd known when I had that trail crew job up in Alaska.
Ooh. Okay.
So it was a good experience. I know, you know, when you work on a fire crew, you always have interesting stories to tell when you come back from fires, but a lot of the work is just kind of make and do and trying to keep busy one way or another, keep your sanity between the fires. And back in the in 1980, we weren't having the mega fires like they have today.
Right.
So, I've often said I'm really glad I had the experience. I'm really glad I had it then.
Yes.
I don't know that I'd want to be on a fire crew these days.
Yeah, it's a different time. Moisture contents are really low.
And you know, it's been another 40 years of growth on the overcrowded forests. So
right.
So yeah.
Were you thinking, okay, I need some more work here, and I'll send out a bunch of forms out to different agencies in the Park Service to see if I can get another detail somewhere.
Yeah, that during the summer, it was we only had one day a week off, and as the deadline came up for winter seasonal positions, I left as soon as I got off work for my one day off and got out of town so that I would be unreachable for a day, and use that day to get all my seasonal applications put together and mailed off for the winter season. I remember searching around Payson looking for a photocopier.
Oh my gosh.
And everybody knew what they were, but nobody had one. I finally found one. There was a bar that had one in the back room. And he said, "Oh, yeah, go ahead and use it." So
nice. Oh, that's nice.
And as I recall, I don't think he even charged me for it. It was because I was a firefighter.
Oh, nice. Where were you applying? Do you remember?
I applied. One of them was Grand Canyon. I don't remember where the other was. So
it'd be Death Valley or Lake Mead or Petrified or
something like that. I had been applying to Grand Canyon all along. It had always been really high on my list. And not to spill the beans, but that was the one that came through. But I don't remember where else I applied for that winter. So after I got off the fire crew with the Forest Service, I just traveled around for a while, close to a month if I remember correctly, just doing some sightseeing, visiting some back roads, this, that, and the other, and then stopped by Petrified Forest to say hi to some old friends, and turned out that some of their seasonals there had left, but they needed a little bit more staff to get them through the shoulder season, and so they picked me up on a 30-day emergency hire to work at the south end of Petrified Forest. So I spent a month down there working, mostly in the Rainbow Forest Museum, talking to visitors and that kind of stuff. The other thing I did while I was there was finished up on my own time, finished up this big coloring map of the park, of Petrified Forest National Park, and sold that to, it was about 3 feet long and maybe 2.5 feet wide, sold that to the Cooperating Association, and I did revise it at one point later on in the late 1980s, but as far as I know, they're still selling it over there.
Wow, so it's like, this is the park, and get the crayons, and you can color it in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh, cool.
Yeah, it was kind of designed for, you know, for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, "Oh, have you ever colored one?" And it was kind of like, no, by the time I got finished drawing it, I was tired of it. But I did finish that up and sold it to the Cooperating Association.
Cool.
And so then but the end of October came along and my 30-day appointment ended, and I still hadn't heard on any jobs. And so I did a little bit more traveling around and went up to Grand Canyon. And I had some friends that worked at Grand Canyon.
Who were your friends that were working there?
Karen Bergeron.
How do you spell her last name?
Bergeron, I think it was.
Okay.
And she was, at that time, the park collections were part of interpretation. So she worked for interpretation, but her big focus was over the museum collection.
Okay.
And then, let's see, Lee Heinrichsen, who's a good friend of mine from Petrified Forest, was working at the canyon as a dispatcher. And
how do you spell Lee's last name?
Oh, let's see, I'm trying to think. I think it's Heinrichsen.
Okay.
And first name is Leigh. And pretty sure she was a dispatcher at that point. So I went up and visited with them, and they said, well, you know, they're still working on filling out the winter roster up here, so go talk to the guys who are doing the hiring. So I did, and
do you remember who you spoke with there? And that would have been in human resources?
No, this would have been some of the other lead interp rangers.
Oh, okay.
And not sure who all was there. The guy that I finally badgered into hiring me was Bob Butterfield.
Okay.
But I stayed up there at the canyon for several, I shouldn't say several, but at least a few weeks. Lee let me camp out on her floor, and I would go in and ask, not on a daily basis, but pretty close to a daily basis, go in and, you know, just see how things were going. And, oh, well, yeah, we're working on, we're working the register, and yeah, you're still in the running. And so I just kind of keep going at them and keep dropping, you know, oh, well, I know how to do this, and I know how to do that. And then periodically to give Lee a break from her house guest, I would go to the backcountry office. And at that time, the backcountry office was in the corner of the visitor center plaza, kind of sandwiched in there between the historic boats. walk up to the window and see what permits they had, and go for a couple of days backpacking in the canyon.
Where did you go?
The first hike I did was actually a disaster. I went down, spent a night at Bright Angel Campground, spent a night at Cottonwood, then Bright Angel, then out. What I hadn't realized was I had cooked the leather in my hiking boots working on fire all that summer.
Oh.
But being in a tanker, I never had to walk very far.
Right.
It won't stretch. And so I put on my boots, and, you know, these are kind of stiff. Well, by the time I got down to Bright Angel Campground, my feet were just covered with blisters because the leather was cooked. It wasn't flexing around my foot anymore. So walking up to Cottonwood the next day, I was walking funny because of all those blisters. And threw my knee out. So then the following day, it took me all day to get from Cottonwood back down to Bright Angel. So I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. And so that night I cleaned up my feet really well and went through and popped all the blisters and bandaged them, and then hiked out the following day with no problem. But I got a very detailed view of the North Kaibab between Bright Angel Campground and Cottonwood, because I was just going so slow.
Oh, dear.
People would stop, say, are you okay? And it's kind of, I knew I was okay. It was just I just couldn't walk any faster.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. I just can't walk. Nothing wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have a good day.
Mm-hmm. So, and then I did another one where I went down to Indian Garden and just spent a couple nights at Indian Garden and used that as a base camp to go day hiking on the Tonto and
nice.
And sort of thing. That was the one, that was back when the old Indian Garden campground that was below, north of the old ranger station. And got an interesting sight. One night I was there in my sleeping bag, and I heard all this crashing on the slope up above the campground. And I kind of clawed my way out of the sleeping bag to see what was going on, just in time to see this big mule deer buck come crashing and rolling into the campsite next to mine.
Wow.
And just landed flat out on the ground. And in the moonlight, I could see him kind of stand up and shake his head a little bit and stagger off into the bushes.
Oh.
Like, okay, that's one of those scenes of nature that you rarely see.
Wow,
what
yeah.
A deer. So, eventually I did wear down the park staff, and they offered me a interp position in the visitor center on the south rim there. And in those days, the three wintertime contact stations, the visitor center, Yavapai, and 2CM Pueblo, were all had their own staffs. So if you worked at the visitor center, that's where you worked. And so I went to work, and they started going through, you know, the usual seasonal orientation and all that kind of stuff. And then Bob Butterfield, my boss, said, you know, you already know all this stuff. Why don't you just go get a volunteer vest out of the closet and put that on and work the desk this afternoon with somebody so you know how things go, and you can just start wearing your uniform tomorrow.
Huh.
So I just kind of hit the ground running. And
so this would have been, as you walk into the headquarters, there's a big open room. And
mm-hmm.
off on the right side, there's a desk, and there's an
mm-hmm.
entrance to some offices through that. There's a little door there that goes into sort of the interp area, interp
mm-hmm.
desks and whatnot there. Is that where you were? Was that that desk?
Yeah, it was at that desk. And then at that time, the right now, when you go back, the door that's behind the desk,
mm-hmm.
not the one that's next to the desk, but the one that's behind the desk went into a big room.
Okay.
It wasn't divided up into offices like it is today.
Okay.
And that was kind of our workroom. And then, so a visitor walking in the door would see the desk there. And then immediately on their left, where the drinking fountain is today, was the Natural History Association, at that time Grand Canyon Natural History Association bookstore. And it was a square that went from the main doors and just kind of squared off that corner of the room.
Okay.
And you'd walk into those bookshelves, and then they had all the books for sale in there. And then the offices that are to your left today when you walk into headquarters, there's a big... the wall has a big opening in it that has been walled off with a subsidiary curved wall with a door to offices in the middle of it.
Okay.
But at that time, that whole big opening was open, and then there were exhibits that ran from there all the way to the west end of the building, straight
wow.
back. So so we had exhibits back there.
Hang on, Carl. I'm kind of confused because there's a set of bathrooms there. You go past the desk, you start into a hallway, it's got a door in it, and
mm-hmm.
just before that door, if you turn right, you go into bathrooms there.
Right.
So this
yeah.
this area that you're describing...
That's going to... Okay, the bathroom setup and the office setup there were the same.
Okay.
today. Actually, GCNHA's offices were there, and so the big hallway with the office, the cubby offices in it today, was to your left as you came in the front doors.
Oh, interesting. So that large open area today was carved into offices there.
Right. The big open area was there. So, you know, with the flagstone floor and all going back to the fireplace.
And the fireplace, yep.
Yep. And then if you walked straight, you'd go out into the plaza.
Right.
And the courtyard there, and the historic boats were still ranged up, you know, around
under
the wall.
Under the overhangs there, yep.
Yep.
Collecting dust.
And then the backcountry office was back there as well.
Okay. And there would have been the law enforcement offices would have been back in there. Dispatch would have been back in there, kind of across the courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
Special collections, museum collection would have been accessed from there.
If you walked in the offices immediately, as you went into the courtyard, along the east wall of the courtyard, the first few offices were Interpen and GCNHA offices.
Okay.
But the last two offices before the door that goes into the hallway that are Interp offices today, or at least were when I retired, those two offices were the backcountry office.
Oh, okay. All right.
And one of them, the one that was right next to the doorway, had a split window so they could, you know, slide the window up and issue permits.
Got it.
Then there was the doorway into the hallway, and then along the north wall, there was most of the north wall, the museum collection was behind.
Right, and there's a meeting room in there?
Yeah, one huge long room.
Okay.
It's since been split up into two, but at that time it was one huge long room. Then the library was in the northwest corner.
Right.
And then,
where it still is, or still where it was last time I was over there.
Yep. As far as I know, it's still there. And then also in the northwest corner, but on the west wall, was a doorway that went into the conference room and what's now the whole green screen room for Interp. That was the dispatch office.
Okay.
And then, don't remember what was beyond dispatch in that space, because the originally the exhibit room, which was along the south wall of the courtyard, you would walk in, going along in the courtyard at the on the west in the southwest corner, there's an airlock doorway, the double doors. And that used to be the exhibit hall exit. And then the exhibit hall was all along the behind that blank wall on the south side of the courtyard.
Okay.
So you'd walk if you walked in from the parking lot into the visitor center, you turn to the right and there was the information desk. You turn to your immediate left and there was the GCNHA bookstore that was walled off with bookshelves, essentially.
Okay.
And then behind that was the exhibit hall.
Hmm.
And originally, and this is going back to the 60s when I came to Grand Canyon as a kid, the exhibit hall was L-shaped, where it went all the way to the west wall of the building and then hooked to the north a little bit. And in that north hook, there was a Navajo rug weaver and a Hopi silversmith working back there.
Wow.
But by the time I started working there, the exhibit hall went straight back, but they'd done something else with that northern extension of it, that L shape, that hook at the end.
Yep, to get turned into law enforcement offices?
It may have been. I don't remember now.
Okay.
So there was the that was kind of our domain. It was the desk, and then the exhibit hall. And our duties, you know, when I first started, it was the dead of winter. And and so we were mostly working the information desk. We would do a nature walk out the trail just there at from headquarters out to the Rim Trail Junction.
Yep.
So we'd do a nature walk out there. And then at that time, we also had a automated slide program, narrated slide program, that ran in the multipurpose room down at the shrine. And that was one where if visitors wanted to see the slideshow, they have to go down to the shrine. And it was set up there in the multipurpose room. And then the also the slide files for doing programs, evening programs, was also down in the shrine in the office that last I saw was the environmental ed office.
So, Carl, most parks have a film about the park or the monument with a little auditorium. But it sounds like Grand Canyon didn't have that.
Not at that time. They did eventually get a film, I think. I kind of missed out on that part. But at that time, we had a slideshow, but it was a fancy setup where it was not just the lapse dissolve, where you have two slide projectors and they alternate back and forth as the lamp goes out in one, the lamp comes on in the other.
Right.
So the slides fade back and forth. So it had that, but it also had a soundtrack, and it was all controlled by, it was called a LaBelle, which is the company that made it. And it played the music and also had the cues that would trigger the slide changes.
Okay.
So and it was all totally automated. We didn't have to go down there and do anything. It would just show the slideshow every half hour. And I say, we didn't have to do anything. Eventually, one of my duties was to go down there and fix it. there was me and one other guy, Rich Leibengood, who kind of had a knack for that sort of thing.
How do you spell Rich's last name?
I think it's L-E-I, but it might be L-I-E-B-E-N-G-O-O-D. And so Rich and I were responsible for keeping that thing going. And the trick was, as you go into the shrine, the multipurpose in the door that faces the parking lot, because that was the door we had open, there's the two doors into the multipurpose room, and then the third door on the left goes into a furnace room. And in the furnace room, there's a fixed ladder attached to the wall that goes up to an opening to a crawl space above the hallway.
Wow.
So we would go in the furnace room, up the ladder, into this crawl space, crawl down to the whole slide projector setup, which was set up in this crawl space and then projected out through windows into the multipurpose room.
Okay. Kind of hard to get to.
yeah. Well, it was, and for all I know, they're still up there. But anyway,
it might be.
So my so my job was to work the information desk and to do those little walks out to the rim.
Hey, Carl. Hang on a second. I'm going to come back to this for a minute.
Okay.
This slide projector was. Had that been designed that way? Was there a window in the wall there? Had that been designed for that? Because in some other research I'm doing, the Park Service was kind of stuck with Emery Kolb. Kolb was doing a film, and the park hated it because it was a terrible film, and it didn't do anything for interpretation or talk about the Park Service and the missions and goals and whatnot. But they couldn't compete with this existing in-holding concessioner, and they didn't even try except with the slideshow.
Well, now, by this point, Emery would be gone because he died in 76, and this was 1980.
Okay, but I'm trying to push this back. Clearly can't because, you know, he didn't show up until the fall of 1980. But clearly that whole system was in place and operating. And I'll have to do some more research to see if that had been operating before, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I mean, they built the visitor center in the 1950s. I remember that.
Right.
And they were well aware of the film issue at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it could be because the space up there, I mean, it wasn't like the AV booth that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go down the crawl space, and there were these two windows, one for each projector, and the speakers. But in the crawl space, there wasn't any kind of exhibit rack or anything like that. The slide projectors and the label unit were just sitting there on the plywood floor.
Okay.
And the lamp changers and all that. So I'm not sure. It certainly predated me, but I don't know by how much.
Right. And clearly the slide show technology in the 70s into the 80s, you know, was starting to do the transition, you know, the two projector transition back and forth. And, it was a big deal. Fade in,
oh,
fade
yeah.
out.
Well, and we had lamp changers as well. So they were the typical Kodak carousel slide projectors.
Right.
And they would hook up to the lapse dissolve unit. At that time, the lapse dissolve was just a lapse dissolve. Eventually that technology evolved to where it could dissolve fast or slow, this and that, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But at that time, it just did it. It did it the way it did it, and that's how it lapse dissolved. There were no settings for it. And then the lamp changer was this carousel full of projector lamps, and the slide projector sat on top of this carousel, and in the slide projector itself, instead of a lamp, there was a mirror, and then the lamp changer had a photo detector in it, and so when the lamp came on and there was no light, the lamp changer knew that the bulb was burned out, and so it would rotate this pan of projection lamps to the next lamp.
Wow.
It held, I don't know, six or seven projector lamps.
So this would have been going, you know, 7 days a week, nine
mm-hmm.
to five kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it was, you know, it was pretty slick. We had a similar sort of thing set up for the evening program, and we did the pretty much like today. We did the evening program in the cold months. We did it in the main auditorium in the shrine, and then in the summertime we did it out at the McKee, what's now the McKee Amphitheater. At that time it was called the Mather Amphitheater, but so.
Where were you staying? Where was your housing then? Where'd you get assigned to?
I lived in one of the dumpsters, so and that's what we called the transit homes. And the transit homes were there were three of them up by the old CCC maintenance yard, which at that time was there's the big wooden building. And
so I'm going to back up a bit. This was the original Park Service maintenance yard with a big warehouse building, what would become the boat shop on the north end, the mm-hmm. was it blacksmith shop, and the mule corral on the south end,
mm-hmm.
or southwest end. And then along the northwest side were these little kind of one-room kind of cabin things.
Right, the labor cabins. Uh-huh.
Okay, and so were those the dumpsters you're talking
no.
about?
No, the dumpsters were on the north side of that lot.
Oh, okay. So next to the boathouse.
Yeah,
What would
the at the
become?
yeah the at that time, of course, the big wooden building was the park warehouse at
Yeah.
that point.
Okay.
The labor cabins were used as summer seasonal housing, but not in the wintertime because they don't have any heat.
Okay.
Then the right at the corner of Navajo and Juniper Hill, there's the fire station,
Right.
the Zentara fire station or the whatever. And then across the street from it was, I think originally it was the paint shop when the CCC built it, but that was the boat shop
Okay.
at the time on the north side of the big parking lot. And then there were three of these transit homes, and they were metal trailers that had a slide-out extension that made the living room a little bit bigger. And they were originally used for the construction camp for Glen Canyon Dam.
Oh my gosh.
And then once Glen Canyon Dam, once the Bureau of Reclamation didn't need them anymore, the Park Service picked up some, and they
So
had
this would
three.
have been these would have been late 1950s models, 60, 70, 80, so they'd have been
Yeah, you could tell.
okay.
But we had three of them there, and then there was another one over at the corner, maybe two of them, over at the corner of Coconino Street and Boulder. Is that right? No, Albright and Boulder, across the street from what's now the Catholic rectory.
Okay.
So I lived in the transit home, the dumpster that was right next to the boat shop.
Okay. Was it
And
the paint shop at that time, or had it
no,
become it had become the boat shop?
it had become the boat shop,
Okay.
yeah. And then in the parking lot, the big parking lot in front of the transit homes, in that little courtyard there, that's where Fred Harvey kept all their buses
Okay.
and warmed them up every morning. So huge clouds of diesel smoke, and that went on for years and years. So yeah, that's where I was living, and sometimes I had a roommate, sometimes I didn't. When I first started working, I didn't have a roommate, but then, late spring, early summer, as things started picking up, I got a roommate. And let's see, on the subject of just talking living arrangements and that sort of thing, back in those days, they still showed second run movies over in the community building, so we could go over there and see movies on Friday nights. And in fact, that might have been the time that Mike Quinn was the projectionist. I'm not sure, but anyway, so you go to the community building, see movies. They were always very, I want to say, casual. I remember they showed Star Wars at one point. Star Wars had been out for how many years, but it finally came to Grand Canyon. And some of my friends, as kind of a surprise, during one of the lightsaber duels, jumped up on the stage with their own
Oh
lightsabers
my gosh.
and had a lightsaber duel up there and things like that. So it was a lot of fun.
So you hired on for a 180 day detail in late October. So November, that should have gone around to some sort of May-ish.
Actually, I started, it was either the very end of November or the 1st of December.
Oh, okay.
And so I was there through the winter months. As summer came on, and that sort of thing. Let's see, my job kind of evolved as staffing levels increased. So I would work the my primary job was working the visitor center desk, and then doing the little nature walks out to the rim. As the weather warmed up, we also did Cedar Ridge hikes. going down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, as I recall.
Okay.
Taking a group of tourists down to Cedar Ridge and back.
So this is, so I'm going to back up a minute. Cedar Ridge is on the Kaibab Trail?
Right, South Kaibab.
And you go
a mile and a half down.
Down some switchbacks and along kind of gentle grade to a place called Ooh-Ah Point.
Mm-hmm.
And then some more switchbacks down to Cedar Ridge. And then you have to turn around and hike back out again, and most of the people who weren't accustomed to elevation had to get out. How did that work?
Usually what we did was I would lead the program down, and this was pretty much SOP for everybody. We'd lead the group down and then hang out at Cedar Ridge. And sometimes we'd have people that wanted to go farther,
mm-hmm.
and they were on their own. But what I would do, we were supposed to follow the folks out to make sure everybody got out okay.
Okay.
And so my strategy or whatever was I would tell people at the end of the program, okay, this concludes the program. You can head back up anytime. If you're worried about getting back out again or whatever, start early so you can take your time. I will be going up the trail in 45 minutes.
Okay.
So if you are concerned about getting back out again and that sort of thing, leave before then, and then I'll catch up with you or whatever. And so I would give them a time, and then I would kind of sweep. I'd hike out with whoever on my group I encountered headed up the trail. I'd slow down and hike the rest of the way out with them.
Great. Give them a little encouragement and just shipping them along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And that was when the weather got nicer and the visitation started going up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And trying to think. So that was, that was, as far as programs go, that was what we did. I did that winter. Nothing was happening at Yavapai because they were remodeling it. And it was during that winter that they put in the exhibits that I worked with in a later job when I came back to Grand Canyon and worked at Yavapai. So that, it was a big remodeling job. And so nobody worked at Yavapai. I did have one day where Tucson Ruin was, for whatever reason, there was nobody available to work there. And so I had to drive out there and work the museum there.
Okay.
It was dead of winter. I had like four people all day long.
Oh, my gosh.
It was one of the longest days I ever worked. And then all of us had various collateral duties. And so my big collateral duty was keeping the slideshow running, which I talked about before, and also working the slide file because, of course, this was in the days before digital photographs. So if you were doing an evening program or whatever, you used slides. And at that time, the park was working with GCNHA. And
that's the Grand Canyon Natural History Association,
right?
GCNHA. Okay.
Yeah. Now GCC, Grand Canyon Conservancy, but
right.
That time GCNHA
and Grand Canyon Association in between the two.
Yep.
Okay.
And they had hired Tom Bean, who's still a photographer, still lives here in Flagstaff.
Yeah.
And he would go out, and the deal was that, well, as I recall, and if you were to interview Tom, he might tell you differently, but as I recall, the deal was that GCNHA bought the film, then Tom would go out and do photography. He would keep the pictures that he wanted professionally, and then the rest of them would go into the slide file.
Okay.
And the idea there was Jack O'Brien, who was the chief of interpretation at the time,
right.
One of his pet peeves was going to different national parks and, you know, going to their evening program and seeing the same slides up on the screen night after night after night after night, because they had a slide file that had, you know, 150 slides in it or whatever. And so what he wanted was a lot of slides so that you wouldn't see the same ones showing up. And, of course, like any good professional photographer, Tom would go out and he would take pictures, but he would take tons of pictures, you know, bracketing the exposures and from this angle and that lighting and yada, 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 yada. So we had thousands of slides.
Wow.
So to make Jack happy, the same slide didn't show up on the screen every night. And there was quite a selection. And they were all stored in notebooks with the little plastic sleeve pages where you slide on the little slides into them. And so one of my other jobs, because the slide file was right there next to the slideshow, so I could keep an eye on it, was to keep the slide file organized. We had notebooks of all different subjects. The interpreters could come in and put together their program. It was kind of like in a library where you don't reshelve your own books. You would just let the quote-unquote professionals reshelve them.
Okay.
Well, we did the same thing with the slides. They could pull out slides, they could put together their program, and then any slides that they didn't use went into a box, and then me and actually Rich was also working the slide files. We would put them back in the notebook so they would wind up in the right places.
Okay.
So that was another collateral duty, and then I also helped with returning lost and found items.
Okay.
So those were kind of my collateral duties.
The lost and found items that weren't returned, did they go to a Lions Club rummage sale? Where did they go?
I'm not sure if they had started doing that yet or not.
Okay.
I only worked the lost and found stuff intermittently.
Okay.
And I just don't remember.
Okay. What do you remember about Jack O'Brien?
Jack was, he was really gruff, but he was also a real funny guy. And there were people who didn't like him. And his management style was kind of a survival of the fittest. And I remember a lot of the supervisors complaining about it, that what he expected them to do was come in and fight for their share of the budget.
Wow.
But at the same time, he was also real forward-looking at the same time. He was, in fact, kind of a nut about technology.
Okay.
And so our slideshow with the labels, slide projectors and all that kind of stuff, he saw computers as the way of the future at that time, I believe, he would have been executive director of the Natural History Association as well, because they hadn't split the park and the cooperating associations apart.
Okay.
Yeah. At that time, there was a kind of incestuous relationship between the cooperating associations and the Park Service. And so he was all gung-ho on having GCNHA start using computers to track and deal with accounting and even word processing and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, you know, I worked for Jack again later on as a permanent, and so I'm not sure exactly which part relates to which, you know, which memories relate to which job I had, but I always got along fine with Jack.
Cool.
You know, I could sympathize with the managers who didn't like his management style, but at the same time, I got along fine with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so
cool.
And let's see, the other thing that I did on that job, which was kind of fortuitous, but I lived right next door to the boat shop. And at one point, they needed somebody to drive a van full of people up to Lee's Ferry for one of the river patrols. And I lived right next door, so they came over and asked me, and said, can you drive up to Lee's Ferry? And I said, sure. You know, I thought that would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so the previous river trip, I don't know who the driver was, but on the way back, he was in a hurry to get back to the South Rim and rolled the van coming out of Lee's Ferry.
Oops.
In the curves there before you get back to, yeah, back to 89A. And so the whole time they were, don't roll the van, don't roll the van, don't roll the van, which I didn't. I went up there, dropped everybody off. It was great, you know, spent a little time at Lee's Ferry and drive back again. So I pulled that off really well.
I'm trying to think of who was there. Kurt Sauer may have been there.
Yeah, I think so.
Crumbo.
Yep.
Guy named Sam West.
Let's see. Ruthie.
Yep.
Ruthie was there. O'Neill. Mark O'Neill.
Yes.
He was. So
Tom Doerr, maybe not. Maybe Tom had left. Not sure.
I think Tom was still there. I certainly know the name. I bet he was.
Okay.
And so
Kimmy, Kim Johnson.
Kim. I know. Yes, she may have been there. This is one where I run into trouble with overlap from the permanent job that I had up there.
Right.
About 3 years later.
Okay.
But so I drove him up, came back, and so I enjoyed it,
mm-hmm.
And so then they asked me to drive down to Diamond Creek for a takeout, and everybody was then telling me, oh yeah, and it's so boring. You absolutely have to take a book to read if they're not there when you get there, because there's just nothing to do. Well, I went down to Diamond Creek and loved it. You know, it was. One thing they hadn't clued me in on was how to find the Diamond Creek Road right
Oops.
After Peach Springs. So I had to kind of poke around a little bit, but eventually found myself on this dirt road heading north and started dropping down into the canyon, so I figured it must be the right one.
Drove past the sawdust burner right there out of town, and you're on your way.
Yeah. It was, at that time, and I'm not sure if I missed the turnoff, but I know that I went up from the old Peach Springs down by the railroad track rather than turning off
right
through the housing area.
Yep.
So, I went down to Diamond Creek and it was just fabulous. I was
nice.
I was interested in geology at the time. And
ooh.
I was like, oh my God, I'm going right on the Hurricane Fault. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. And so,
Were you doing this on your days off, or were you doing this as part of your interp duties to help the boat shop?
I think I was doing it on my days off.
Okay.
Gratis, if I recall correctly, which now looking back, it's kind of, oh my God, what could go wrong with that?
Oh, nothing. It's just fine. Keep driving.
Yeah.
You'll be fine. Don't roll the van.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I can't remember. I think I only went to Diamond Creek once, but I may have gone to Lee's Ferry a couple of times.
Hmm.
But in any event, when the end of my season came in August, they said, well, you know, you've been so helpful doing this. We'll give you a river trip. And so it was a Phantom Down, the lower half.
Okay, hang on. Let's stop right there, because I'm going to ask you a zillion questions about that. And we've been going for about an hour 20 here.
Okay.
So maybe this is a good place to put a comma in at the end of part four before we start part five, and we'll talk about the river trip.
Okie dokie.
Great. Is there anything else you want to add about that first 180-day detail before we land you on the river?
Not really. You know, there were a bunch of fun little stories. My evening program I'll get more into it when I start talking about my permanent job. But my evening program was about evolution.
Okay.
And so I talked about the fossils of the Grand Canyon, and then finished up with what today we call the sixth extinction. And I discovered early on that I could give a whole evening program about evolution, and people just loved it as long as I didn't say evolution.
Interesting.
If I let the E word slip out during the program, they'd be lined up with baseball bats afterwards.
Wow.
But as long as I didn't use the E word, I got through it just fine, and they loved it. And at one point, this was in the shrine, and kind of a hint of things to come. Spring break was not as big then as it is now, but it was already, Grand Canyon was already starting to become a popular place over spring break.
Mm-hmm.
And there, we had, we'd used the auditorium in the shrine, and over spring break, I gave the program, and it was so full that I opened up the curtains on the windows on the north side of the shrine and took one of the speaker stands out the back door so that people could stand outside the windows and look in to see the evening program.
Gosh.
There were just so many people there.
Wow.
For that show. So, and then another night, I gave the evening program, and about a third of the way through, this group of people came in and sat down, watched the program, and then afterwards came up and apologized for showing up late. And they were a geology group, geology class from some university, I can't remember which, and they asked. They said, I know it's an imposition and you're supposed to get off work, but could you do the first part of your program again?
Oh, my gosh.
See it? And so I did. And I said, so I think this is about where you came in. And then we spent the whole rest of the slideshow. I just went through the slides one by one. And they were asking me questions about the geology and just about the canyon in general, slide by slide. So it was exactly not an interpretive program. It was talking about the slides, but it was... It was a very fun evening.
And, yeah, I bet you would have just eaten that up.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
people that are interested in what you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, it was a different kind of question as well.
Yeah. Nice.
Instead of people who were here on vacation and wanted to learn anything, these were people who had already learned a lot and wanted to learn more.
Right.
So.
And I think of you driving down the Diamond Creek Road as a Brer Rabbit in the briar patch.
It was kind of amusing. I did run off the road at one point. I didn't flip the van, but I did run off the road at one point.
Because you were looking at the rocks?
I was looking at the Hurricane Fault.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, with that, we'll wrap up part four here of Oral History Interview with Carl Bowman. Today is Tuesday. It's November 10th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Carl, thanks so very much.
Sure. It's been great.